will say that I have shed innocent blood. What's blood for, if not for shedding? With my hook for a hand, I'll split you from your groin to your gullet. I came for you.
Welcome to Now Playing's Candyman movie review series.
The urban legend is, if you say his name five times while looking in the mirror, he appears in the reflection and kills you.
Hosted by Arnie.
You like hanging out with this Latin lover because he's dangerous?
Stuart.
He's the monster that's part of this neighborhood.
And Jacob.
You are not content with the stories, so I was obliged to come.
This podcast may contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
These stories are modern oral folklore.
Listener discretion is advised.
Now I must shed innocent blood. Come with me.
Be my victim.
Today, we're discussing Candyman, Farewell to the Flesh. Starring Tony Todd, Kelly Rowan, Timothy Carhart, and Veronica Cartwright, directed by Bill Condon. Are you with me, Nolans? Do you hear me? This is the Kingfish coming to you from Now Playing, anointed and appointed, but you can call me Arnie.
And Stuart.
And this is the host with hoods on his shoes and horns on his head, Jacob.
Well, people said Candyman five times for theaters, and so quick after, we got a sequel. And different creative team, though, because Bernard Rose, he had in contract, he could give them a draft of a script. He wrote a script, or at least a treatment, and was turned the fuck down.
Yeah, from what I read, it's because no Tony Todd in it? No Candyman?
Right. I read the title, Candyman 2, The Midnight Meat Train. So I was like, okay, they're going to go with a different Barker. Like, that's not a bad way to go, I suppose. It would at least be original and fresh. But why would you call it Candyman 2 if Tony Todd is not here?
I mean, they called Halloween 3 Halloween.
Nah, good point. So what was the story, Arnie?
I do think that Tony Todd or Virginia Madsen might have been saved for the end, but it was going to be an adaptation of The Midnight Meat Train, and it was going to take place in London, but it was going to involve Jack the Ripper instead of, you know, Vinnie Jones is who we had in the actual Bradley Cooper adaptation, but it was going to be Jack the Ripper on the London tube killing people, and then when they finally found there was supposed to be a cannibal woman bathed in blood. Apparently at the end, instead of going to the ancient ones like we got in the Barker story, it goes to Buckingham Palace and the royals are okay. The cannibals.
Oh, so it's a documentary. I believe they are eating people.
I don't know how that woman is still alive. It has to be some secret diet.
She's eating people. There are satanic rituals going on there.
A good excuse as any, I guess. And that does sound like a movie you say no to. I can understand why you say, Bernard, go make your Beethoven movie. Go make Immortal Beloved. We'll all be happier.
To me, that script sounds like something Bernard Rose might have written because he did say several times on the commentary he didn't want to do a sequel at all, and maybe he thought he could get paid for writing the sequel and then also have a script that maybe he could take to Clive and be like, Clive, let me go do Midnight Meat Train now while somebody else does shitty sequels to a slasher film.
Yeah, it sounds like you're definitely not interested in honoring or continuing what you started. And so I can't blame the producers for saying, let's go find a different director. Let's find someone that is willing to do the same thing again in a little bit different way. Let's find Bill Condon, who maybe he's not as artsy-fartsy as Rose, but turned out to be a respectable director, has had a long career mixing it up between musicals and period films and horror.
I mean, he did one of the top grossing movies of 2017. This is the guy who directed Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to start there. For me, the high point was his movie about Albert Kinsey. Liam Neeson played the famed sex researcher mapping sexual human history in conservative 1950s. It was a good film. And Gods and Monsters, that was a Clive Barker-ish thing. Ian McKellen.
I saw it. It was okay.
I saw that. That wasn't a horror, though, was it?
Well, I mean, no. I mean, it had elements. It was about the director of Frankenstein, and it involved World War II. But, yeah, I mean, he's good with actors. You know, like Eddie Murphy got one of his best parts in decades with Dreamgirls. That was him.
Yeah, but this is a slasher sequel. Are they worried about having a director that's good with actors?
Hey, Jacob, you know this guy. You've seen at least two of his films, Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn Part 1 and 2.
The best of the Twilight films, especially that last one.
Okay, I'll take your word for that one. Haven't seen any of those. But anyway, my point is, you know, this could have gotten handed off to some music video guy who has nothing on his credits. It's interesting that we got a director that has gotten people statues and is noted and kind of keeps Candyman in the realm of being kind of an elevated artsy horror movie and not just Friday the 13th.
And I think part of the reason we might have gotten that is it does say at the beginning, story by Clive Barker. Now, I don't know if they just mean it was based on the original story, The Forbidden by Clive Barker, but Barker was an active executive producer of this film. He did keep his fingers in this pie. It wasn't like Hellraiser 5, where he just raised his hand and said, "Be gone with you," or Candyman 3, for that matter.
Yeah, he raised his hand to sign a check.
Yeah, but I mean, even in signing a check, you probably care a little bit more than when you have no attachment. You don't know what they're doing. And, you know, a lot was changed from his story. It's worth pointing out the whole Cabrini-Green angle. None of that was in what Clive conceived. So, yeah, if people are going to take that direction and go with race-based horror, I mean, that's outside of Clive Barker's realm. But I think that, yeah, he's probably going to encourage that. And so, yeah, we got a sequel 3 years later that will be the last Candyman movie to maybe ever be in theaters. Who knows if this new one is coming out yet, but it's been at least 25 years since Candyman has appeared.
And I didn't see this when it came out. I didn't love the first one when I saw it. And so when this came out in March 95, I paid attention. I was still very into Barker, as you can hear, because Hellraiser 4 was coming out near the same time. And this, I waited for video. I checked it out there. Here's the funny thing. This is my fourth time watching this film.
Fourth?
I watched it on video when it was new, and then I watched it while I was doing just a Clive Barker rewatch on my own in the aughts. I rewatched it when we did Hellraiser, just because I was watching every Clive Barker and kind of recapping where his film career was at that point. Coming into this one, I'm like, what could I remember? I couldn't remember a damn thing. Three watchings. I thought the New Orleans one was the one that was Day of the Dead.
That would make sense.
And before this Candyman franchise, I didn't even know there were sequels. So definitely have not seen this one.
Yeah, this one did poorly. I mean, it did $10 million less than the original movie. Usually you want to build your audience. And, you know, they opened up against Outbreak. I don't know if people were much more excited about the horrors of Dustin Hoffman in those outfits. For whatever reason, it made less than Halloween 6.
Ouch!
It made less than New Nightmare. It made less than Jason Goes to Hell. Whatever standing he had for being the new face of horror, it slipped. Tony Todd was on his ass.
I gotta wonder if part of this involves the politics. The first movie we talked about, people were probably very interested in race relations and Rodney King, right? I couldn't even find the picture online. If one of our listeners can find this, I'd love to see this poster. The original poster for this movie was Candyman chasing after the main character, a blonde woman. And, oh, the backlash was severe and immediate. You're capitalizing on OJ murdering his wife.
Oh, wow. I know.
I read about that, yeah.
Oh, wow. You know, I wasn't thinking about 1995 and what that meant to come out then. But holy shit, you're right. There's nothing that consumed people more than that day-by-day, all-day-long coverage of that, yeah, murder of the century, I guess is how it was billed. So you're right. Whether they intended it or not, that was going to be what people focused on.
And it may just be people at that time, if you were going to see a black guy attack a blonde woman, you wanted to watch it on court TV, not in theaters. That may be why Halloween 6, did you say, did better?
It did, by a couple million. I mean, not by, like, it wasn't like boatloads, but, you know, again, you want to do better than the curse of Michael Myers. But maybe the movie is better. Again, what it did in box office is not to say that, you know, that's the quality of the film. We got to get into it. Arnie, give him the plot of Farewell to the Flesh.
Kelly Rowan plays New Orleans grade school teacher. I'm sorry, in this movie, Nolan's grade school teacher, Annie McKeever. Her brother Ethan, played by William O'Leary, has been troubled ever since their father was murdered a year earlier and Ethan found the body. Compounding that, their mother Octavia, played by Veronica Cartwright, is dying of cancer. Now, on the eve of Mardi Gras, Ethan is under arrest for a murder that Ethan knows was actually committed by the Candyman, again played by Tony Todd. The Candyman seems to swirl around Nolens as Annie's student Matthew, a gifted artist, keeps drawing pictures of Candyman. To prove to the class there is no real Candyman, Annie says his name into a mirror 5 times. Nothing happens in the classroom, but that night, while Annie is home with her husband, Candyman shows up and disembowels the man. But he leaves Annie alive, and the police wonder if Annie might be the murderer. With Candyman having murdered 3 people and only Annie or Ethan as suspects, Annie starts to investigate the legendary killer. Plus, her student Matthew has disappeared. Did the Candyman get him? Annie finds a snow cone salesman slash art dealer who knew about Annie's father.
Black market art dealer, no less.
Yeah.
His name is Honoré, played by Matt Clark. Honoré data dumps a lot of information about Candyman, including he was born in Nolens, and he reminds us Candyman fell in love with a white woman, got her pregnant, and then a mob killed him for that interracial love. And Candyman's real name was Daniel Robitaille. And after he died, his beloved, Caroline, moved back to New Orleans from Cabrini Green to raise their child. Plus, as he was killed, Daniel looked into Caroline's mirror, and as he was being called the Candyman, he says Candyman, and his spirit is trapped in that mirror, and that's why he emerges from mirrors to unleash his vengeance. Candyman kills Honoré and lets Annie know she's pregnant with a daughter. And this hardly matters, but to up the body count, Candyman also kills a cop who's, like, beating on Ethan, and then Ethan is shot by the cops because he's blamed for that murder. And in all this, it doesn't take Annie long to figure out that she's Candyman's great-great-granddaughter, a secret her mother knew but would never admit. And her father had been trying to banish Candyman by finding and destroying Caroline's mirror, but when he failed to find it, he summoned Candyman as a form of suicide. After this exposition, Candyman kills Annie's mother. Annie goes to her family's old run-down estate, which is where Candyman was born. There, she finds the mirror and smashes it, killing Candyman. She also finds the missing Matthew, who was hiding there out of fear of Candyman. We then jump 5 years later. Annie has named her daughter Caroline, after her great-great-grandmother, and the daughter starts to say Candyman 5 times... But Annie stops her at the last minute as credits roll.
And you know, of all the people that weren't coming back, Bernard Rose and Virginia Madsen, and who knows really how much Clyde Barker participated, the one I would have never guessed is here. Philip Glass? They got the man that, like, pretended he didn't write this score. They got the score back.
All right. He apparently was very nice about it. Is they knew they wanted to use the Philip Glass score, and Bill Condon was trying to work it out, and finally he's like, you know, we needed more music for this. We can use a lot of what he did before, but Annie needed her own theme. So they went to Philip Glass, and he agreed to write a couple more pieces of music. He wrote another piece for Annie's theme, and then he actually scored a cut scene near the end during the Mardi Gras scene and some of the flashbacks. He did a normal score where he looked at the film and timed the music to it. I don't know why he talked so bad about the first one and then came back so readily for the second one, but he did.
I'm surprised that they got new music out of him. I thought they just repurposed it. I mean, he repurposes stuff. He's a minimalist composer. He has like the same 3 notes repeating over and over in a song.
Sure, sure. There's another repeat here too as we begin, and it's a fun callback.
This is the one I thought you were talking about.
Well, this is the classic kill, right? Like, if they survive the first one and they shouldn't have, they're going to get it in part two and early.
And really, this is the only guy who survived the first one, right? Michael Culkin's character, Philip Purcell, he was the one who they were going to bury at dinner that night. And he's like, how are you going to bury us if you don't even know the story of the Candyman, the slave's son, who the shoemaker who became a wealthy artist?
Right. He knew so much about it, but he got the wrong city. Okay. It's kind of a big mess up. If it all really happened in New Orleans, but you said it happened in Chicago.
They hedge it. He was born in New Orleans. His dad, the slave, was in New Orleans. And then he went up north to the fancy schools. And the woman he was painting was up in Chicago. He was killed up in Chicago. And then she went to the family home, you know, that was bought with all that shoemaker money in Nolens after he was killed.
See, I have a simpler take on all of this. You know, stories migrate. Like, things happen at one area, and then people move and change, and suddenly the story gets changed that, no, it actually happened over here and all. I took it to mean that everything we knew about Chicago is true, except it happened down south, where it makes more sense. Let's just call it out what it is. Below the Mason-Dixon line, this story makes a whole lot more, it connects more with American history.
And at least with our stereotypes of that history, lots of racist stuff went up in those Yankee states as well, I'm sure. But yes, you associate this kind of gruesome murder because of an interracial affair with the South.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I love the opening here. I love the idea of bringing Purcell, that snooty character. He's got a book now.
I loved it has a mirrored cover on there.
That is great marketing.
Yeah, exactly. He's going to prove to the audience that it's just a story. I'm going to recite his name into it. And then I have some little punk waiting behind my slideshow to make the hook pop out. Because I'm just really at heart a ham and a cheesy guy that loves this myth for what it is.
And he must be selling those books pretty well, because that's like a couple $100 projector if he's having that shredded at every book reading. I mean, I saw Ted Nugent in concert, and I caught the guy who replaced Ted Nugent's really expensive guitar with some balsa wood before Ted Nugent fired a flaming arrow into it. So, but this was the real screen.
Yeah, do you think Purcell had that in his rider when his agent would book him on these? You gotta have a screen I can destroy.
I don't know. But again, it's all kinds of fun. Just to have that callback, I wasn't expecting it. And yeah, it's just the kind of thing that's going to get you killed. You know, you're arrogant enough to write about Candyman. He's got to be happy that he's in a bestseller, right? Like, he wants fame. So that part is good. But yeah, you're going to like denounce him as just a story and recite his name into your mirrored cover. That's going to get you, well, first it's going to get you attacked by a man who claims you killed his dad. That apparently Ethan Tarrant, his father hunted this guy down a year ago or so, and Purcell said, yeah, don't worry about it, and that's why these main character kids are orphans.
And Purcell, I find it hard to believe that this book is published. None of his friends, is this his very first book reading? Has he never been as part of a stage show or as part of, you know, just hanging out with friends who are talking to him about this book? He's never had to say Candyman five times until he got down to New Orleans.
Yeah, Ethan will say, you brought him to New Orleans because you said his name five times, which I don't know if you guys watch South Park, but they did this whole thing with Biggie Smalls, where if you said Biggie's name five times, he'd like show up at your place and it's really inconvenient. He's always trying to get to some party and then get zapped to whoever's bathroom because they say his name five times. Like, that's where my mind went, because that's the only way Candyman could get around, apparently.
Yeah, it's a silly rule. I mean, again, when you think about the logic of it, of course there's no truth to this. Of course it's a myth, because how would this work? There would be so many millions of people saying this all over the place, sometimes simultaneously. Like, there's no, I mean, this, of course it's a story, and a bad one at that, but it perpetuates because we love the idea of it. And so, yeah, how is Purcell going to blow off the fact that this man says, you killed my father? I'm just going to go have a drink, and we're going to have the bouncer throw you out.
And, of course, as soon as he's alone with a mirror in a bathroom, Candyman's going to show up. And might I just say, this kill of this douchebag is such a better opening than Ted Raimi. It fits more with the story. It allows for a data dump at the beginning in case you don't remember the first film or didn't see it. Now you know who the Candyman is. And we still have an opening kill where within the first 10 minutes, some guy is gutted and we're happy about it, just because if for no other reason than that ponytail alone, he needed to die.
And this is the first time that Candyman is killed that it hasn't been overtly sexual. Or maybe it is overtly sexual, but it doesn't feel like going groin to gullet is the same thing as you know, plowing the guy here.
Yeah, I definitely feel like this is a different production where this is more of a slasher. All that mood from that Bernard Rose brought is gone, and which is fine. I could be happy with just a slasher, but it does feel different right away.
According to Bill Condon, there's a brief moment where Purcell is talking to a stranger in the bathroom, and he's like, "That's my book." Apparently, he was trying to pick up that stranger in the bathroom, so...
I thought that was a weird line, just to be like, "That's my book." Like, is that a pickup line that writers use?
No, yeah, I definitely felt like Purcell could probably go for that. I just didn't know whether Candyman would be into it. You're right. They've changed the MO in lots of ways, the way that he's killing and who he's preying on. It's less the psychological thriller and more the standard slasher sequel. And that's okay, because it's Candyman 2.
But it doesn't look as good. You know, I noticed that right away. Now, we are in some dingy bar bathroom, but when Candyman appeared in the first one, remember, we didn't see him in the opening kill at all last time. We just saw blood coming through the floor and heard screams. And when he appeared, he was dark shadow and really felt ominous. Here, Tony Todd just kind of looks like a guy with his collar popped, right? I mean, the way it's lit, it's naturalistic lighting, it's fluorescence like you'd find in a bathroom, but he doesn't look monstrous or scary in this shot.
You know what? I wasn't totally in love with the look of the movie last time. I thought it looked a little washed out. I'm not having any problem with it.
But I do like the look of the film once we get to Mardi Gras and filming in New Orleans, and I don't know who this Kingfish is. I think he also did the voice of Gambit for X-Men the Animated Series. I've been to New Orleans 3 times. I've never met somebody who talks like this. Not once. Not even in the cheesy tourist restaurants for where they sell crawfish. I have not found anyone who speaks like this. I'm very disappointed by that, by the way.
I think it's a great idea to get out of Cabrini Green. Like, I'm so glad that they're not rehashing that. Because, I mean, we wondered that. After Friday the 13th, Jason could have gone anywhere. He could have left behind summer camp. And it's kind of dismaying, frankly, that he never, until part 8, which was...
Well, you know how you feel about when he goes to Manhattan.
Yes. Be careful what you wish for. But yes, I felt like it did get a little bit samey feeling because the location remained the same. So the fact that they're going to go to a different area and experience black culture in a different way here in New Orleans, I think is perfect.
Conceptually, I don't know how much they actually explore black culture. There's going to be a lot of African-American characters in this, but I don't feel like we ever get that depth like we did with the first one.
Yeah, the DJ here, you mentioned Kingfish. He says the subtitle of this film, Farewell to the Flesh, Carnival. Is that true? Is that what it means?
I Googled this, and he's taking some liberties. Carnival actually means to put away meat.
To put away meat.
Okay. Put away meat. Put away meat, man. I'm getting images that... Farewell to the Flesh.
So when I come home from the grocery store, I perform Carnival when I put my hamburger into the refrigerator, is what you're saying. I'm putting away my meat.
Yeah, that's one translation. You know, Latin to English is a little iffy, but it comes from the Latin expression carne levare, which means remove meat. And so that becomes carneval or farewell to meat. So I think if you look at meat, you know, and you're Clive Barker, who loves to talk about flesh, it's all about flesh, then meat could be flesh, and thus, so they're stretching it, they're bending it, but I don't quite understand farewell to meat either. I mean, it is Mardi Gras, and it's the day before Lent, where you're not allowed to eat meat.
I do feel like, though, there's a lot of flesh at Mardi Gras. Like, that's kind of what it's known for. Throw those beads.
Right, but what they say is, with Lent, you're not supposed to eat meat. First, you were never supposed to eat meat, and then it became, all right, just don't do it on Fridays, because the Catholics want money. But they say that Carnival has a Christian origin because of the meat thing.
Yeah, they talk a lot about Lent and Ash Wednesday and all that, which I know has something to do, I think, with Catholicism. I know Mardi Gras has something to do with that, but it's such a weird, trying to put like those Mardi Gras parades next to, you know, going to church and taking communion. It just feels very weird.
The thing is, you're supposed to get all your sinning out of your system.
Is that what it is? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's like New Year's Eve. Like, I'm never going to do this after tomorrow, but tonight, you know, the flesh is going to enjoy it, you know? So maybe it should be called Candyman Hide the Sausage. Like, I do feel like it is about people, like, getting it on. And so, like, this thing is built. Like, we're on a Saturday, and it's going to build to the 3 days where we get this Mardi Gras full on. I mean, it's, again, a good conceptual premise to take any horror movie, really, but Candyman specifically.
Yeah, I really like New Orleans as a setting. You know, I think we talked about it when we did Body Heat. I just think New Orleans is a rich cultural area. It's full of diverse people. And I think it uses New Orleans pretty well. I mean, they did film on location for a lot of the outside stuff here.
Had to. And not just Bourbon Street.
No, no. They went downtown to the police station and things. Now, I have been to New Orleans during Celebration, and there's not enough vomit on the streets, and there's not enough people on the streets. This doesn't have the realism of being there.
It does feel like an anemic Mardi Gras.
But I like that they're setting it there. I really do.
And so, yes, this DJ has kind of set the mood. I like having him kind of being this unseen largely. Eventually, we'll see him like in a DJ booth or surrounded by flames looking like Bacchus. But by and large, he's just sort of the narrator setting the tone for a town that believes. I mean, he's actually going to say, don't be looking in that mirror. Like, it's understood, much as it was in Cabrini. This is home to a Candyman, and people know it's part of the tradition. There's signs posted, like hooks with, like, don't do it, like, slashes through them. Thou shalt not kill. So, like, the town has a strange awareness about the Candyman among them.
Which makes me wonder why he needed Virginia Madsen so bad. If she'd only dispelled him in Cabrini, there's a lot of people in New Orleans afraid.
Yeah, no, we didn't, again, yeah, she was just trying to get the Chicago chapter started. But, like, down here, well, that job is being given to Kelly Rowan, not to be confused with Destiny's Child Kelly Rowland from Freddy vs. Jason.
I really did. I really thought that that would be the star of this film.
Yeah, I was confused too. I saw the name in the credits, and then I'm like, that ain't Kelly Rowland. But it's not Tuesday night either. Apparently, she was offered the part and turned them down from Elm Street 4, Arnie.
Yeah, she's done so much with her career, she could afford to be turning down parts.
Instead, Kelly Rowan, apparently, she played Peter Pan's mom in Hook and played the mom on the TV show The OC. She's basically, her attributes are, why she gets this gig is she's blonde like Virginia Madsen. It is another blonde chick being desired by a black killer. They want to keep that racial tension.
Well, and as the plot summary says, she's his descendant. So obviously blonde would work, because if you're Virginia Madsen's clone's great, great, great granddaughter, then those genes would be there.
Virginia Madsen? She has nothing to do with it. You're assuming that Helen was literally that woman? I mean, maybe. Or maybe she was just hypnotized.
It's implied that she's like the reincarnation of the beloved.
Candyman pulls that shit at every corner of the world. No, you're my real Caroline. Yeah, it was always you. Like, he's pulling that shit in the Philippines. But anyway, she's all right. I mean, I feel like she's kind of a bland. She doesn't have the charisma of Virginia Madsen. She's a goody-goody. It's a strange part in that she's from a privileged upper-crust society family, but she's working in the inner city at St. Vincent School, which is so hard that they actually have classes on Saturday. I can't believe these kids are in school on Saturday.
It felt really Dangerous Minds to me.
Yeah. And, you know, she's having them do activities and they're talking about Candyman. We have this one student, Matthew, who's continuing to sketch Candyman. I really don't understand why they include this character into this plot. I really don't know why we need to have the children be a part of this story.
Yeah, this feels like so much filler. Like, they go, okay, last time a baby was put into danger, and that's why Helen was so concerned with dealing with Candyman and resolving that. Maybe if we do that again, we'll put a teenager this time, though.
This Annie has a lot going on. First of all, it was her brother that accosted Purcell, and he's, like, arrested. That would be plenty. Plus, her dad is murdered. She's trying to figure out who does that. Her husband's going to get murdered. I don't think she also needs to be looking for missing students, like, all on Mardi Gras. It's like she's got like five too many tasks to go here. And I really feel like this school stuff doesn't yield a lot. Whenever we're here, I feel like the movie is, slowing down, filler, just kind of treading water until it can get to the good stuff.
It doesn't add anything to her character. In fact, I would almost prefer it if we had a different storyline where maybe she's a lawyer or somebody really focused on her business and she's thinking about aborting the child because it's going to interfere with her career, you know, things like that. And then the candy man comes along and wants her to keep it. I don't know. What I'm basically saying is Dream Child did it better.
By the time I get to the end of this, it's this whole thing you're going to find out she's a descendant of Candyman, and there's something about these white people that don't want to admit that they come from the son of a former slave, and they're trying to hide the secret. Like, have that play out. Like, I don't know, is she mistrustful of these students? Something like that feels what her character arc should be, is embracing her true genealogy.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of ways to make her more interesting.
There's something they need to do rather than what they do here.
But you know what, Helen, there were similar problems. She had a thesis. We never quite knew what it was. It was always nebulous. The point is, both characters were involved in a school. We're going to just do that again. And so they got that going here. But her brother, Ethan, is in police custody. And we do have this early scene here where she's going to gather her mother and come down to City Hall to talk with him and see why he thinks he killed this guy.
Do we need Ethan in this movie? I mean, I get it that it's a sequel. You got to try to up the body count. Candyman 1 had a pretty low body count, all things considered. Candyman 2 is not going to make that mistake. We're going to have a lot of people killed. But I feel that there's so many people in this movie that are completely useless characters narratively. And Ethan's a big one.
Well, last movie we had someone that was, well, maybe she was guilty of the murders, but she was wrongly convicted by the police, accused of, you know, killing dogs and killing babies when she wasn't. I think they're trying to do something with that here. Ethan, he says, "I killed Purcell," but he knows that he didn't, right? I mean, and we know he didn't.
I mean, furthermore, there's going to be a point that where they're going to have Candyman show up in the prison and kill a cop, and we're going to see the video footage. It's not, is it really Helen thinking of all this? Is it really Ethan acting this out? No, we'll see, like, people magically floating in the air getting gutted.
Yeah, because Candyman is now a vampire where he can't be photographed.
But we didn't see him in the first movie. Again, he was floating above her.
Yeah, but we never saw him having an effect on someone. Like, we didn't see someone get gutted mysteriously. It was always assumed it was Helen. That was always an out that, or a theory that movie you could go with, that it's really Helen doing all that. They totally blow that away in this one.
Okay, so what is important? If we're saying we don't love the school stuff and we don't like the wrongly convicted brother subplot, do we like Lambert from Alien? Veronica Cartwright is here as the mother who has a secret. She's always messing with the security system. She keeps these photographs locked in her dresser and won't talk about why her husband died and is also dying in a strange bit of symmetry.
See, I like the father dead thing. I think that had a purpose. You could have had that it was Annie who found the father instead of Ethan. You could have merged those two characters pretty easily and better repeated what the last film did, which was, even if we, the viewer, don't have that mind game of is it all in Helen's head, here, you know, we could at least have the cops coming after Annie the way that, I mean, they just arrest Ethan off the bat. You could have had them, you know, and we do get a little bit of cops following her, but mostly I don't feel that plays out. Merging those two characters and then having the mother who's dying and secretive and the father who was murdered under mysterious circumstances, that is a decent story hook.
Okay. Yeah, I'm with you. I'll support that. But be that as it may, so this one is sloppier. You're right. They have more people, presumably because they're going to kill more people. But it takes a really long time to get to Candyman again. I mean, yeah, he popped up at the beginning. But by and large, they're going to, you know, wait the same 40 minutes to get there. There's a lot of time with her kind of just hanging out with her husband, painting self-portraits, and, you know, going back to the old plantation.
It's about 35-ish minutes, maybe 37, that Candyman shows up. I wrote it down because I felt like it was 10 minutes earlier, and that was a big 10 minutes. Candyman feels omnipresent. Yes, we have this setup at the beginning, but I don't feel like it lingers that long. And the weirdest thing is, Annie's husband. For some reason, when we're seeing her in the beginning, I just don't peg her as married, a young school teacher. And then this guy she's married to is a bartender that looks like Emilio Estevez grew a goatee.
I think he runs the place. To be fair, I think he's closing up shop. So he runs a restaurant or runs a bar. But I agree, they're a weird match. And I'm not sure why you would make her a married woman. But again, the main character was married last time. And so are they going to have a he's cheating on her storyline? No, they're just going to see some couple screwing on the balcony and say, do you want to do the do and go home and have some sex and get hooked? Like the classic slasher idea that if you're going to have sex in a horror movie, even when you're married, you're going to get it. But she blames herself. I think what we're supposed to understand is earlier in that day, she, in order to break up a fight at school, is going to recite Candyman five times into the mirror. And had she not done that, then presumably she would never be on the trail of who killed her father. And he would never be able to come to her and basically spend the whole movie courting his last descendant.
Yeah, she got the genie out of the bottle.
But he's already been let out of the bottle by Purcell. That's what we're told at the beginning. You brought him to Nolens.
Right. Yeah. Again, he's everywhere because, I mean, people are probably doing this all over. He's hopping around. But again, I think the point is it always feels special for the person that recites the name in the mirror. And Annie's story with Candyman is going to be that he is going to answer secrets about her family history that have always been hidden from her.
Except, you know, most people who say Candyman five times are killed instantly. Like Purcell, he says it five times and like Candyman shows up. There's no dialoguing. There's no, you called me. It's just, I'm here and now I'm impaling you. But Helen and Annie, they get, you know, Candyman plays with his food there. And the husband never said Candyman. So because Annie called Candyman, now everybody around Annie is fair game, similar to Helen last time.
It's like those later Hellraiser movies where like you're supposed to open the box and like within 10 seconds here comes hooks, and then those later movies it's like no, it's going to be 90 minutes before you find Pinhead showing up here.
But the box was open the whole time.
Right. Yeah. So the rules are nebulous. And again, I think in this story, it's okay because the rules are ever changing. Urban legends, there's always variation, right? There's no true history. There is nothing that you can point to fundamentally and say, this is the true story of Candyman. His story morphs.
And I wish that's what these movies were about. I agree with you, Stuart. I wish we would learn something new about Candyman. I guess we'll learn his name and how he got the name Candyman. Spoiler, people just called him Candyman because honey was put on him.
It's a really shocking surprise, isn't it?
It's huge revelation.
Stuart, you're holding to this urban legend thing, and I'll agree, that's what the first movie is about. I don't see that the second movie is really about urban legend so much as it's about a ghostly killer.
Yeah, all right, so let's get to that. All right, we're 37 minutes in, and we've met all of the characters, and Annie's broken the rules, and we've been waiting. What's going to happen here? Who of this cast of characters is going to get killed first? It is the husband bringing a tray of food, and she's not that upset about it. Like, the strange thing is, Candyman is like, be with me, you're mine. She faints, and then that's it. She wakes up and she's like, well, does this prove my brother's innocent? I don't even think she sheds a tear for this husband. It's all of like, well, then my brother couldn't have done the murder because this is just like the other one with Purcell, and you know, you had him under lock and key.
And here's the other crazy thing about Candyman wanting Annie to be with him. Is he into incest? Because this is like his blood grandchild or something.
He doesn't say, be my victim or anything. He says, be my witness. I think he wants to just keep her alive long enough that the bloodline can continue and then he'll probably kill her. But you guys keep saying, you know, be with me and things. Now all I'm picturing is like Candyman at Valentine's Day having those little candies. It's be mine with B-E-E, mine.
Yeah, covered in bees.
Yeah, spelled out with actual hornets and wasps and bees, yes.
Dripping with honey, yeah.
A cute line of Hallmarks you could release at time for this movie if you wanted to do such a thing.
But I did like how she clawed his face and the bees came out.
That was a good effect.
Yeah, but you're right. She and her husband have no chemistry, and he seemed weird hanging around the whole time, and she does not care that her husband is dead.
Right. So, again, I feel like this movie is having a hard time with focus. What do people want? What does Annie want? What does Candyman want from her? These things are very nebulous. There's a lot of people. But I will say this. I'm still engaged, even though that this is lesser, it looks lesser, it feels lesser, I'm still feeling intrigued. Maybe it is just the New Orleans allure, but I feel like this is better than I thought it was going to be.
And it's worse than I thought it was going to be. Even though I couldn't remember much about it, I thought I remembered enjoying this movie a bit when I watched it back when we did Hellraiser. And here, I'm feeling like we are in a pretty basic slasher, as you mentioned, without a lot of character motivation other than I'm running from this ghost who can pop up anywhere and kill me. I am liking, again, the score is good in this one. I'm liking some of the imagery of Mardi Gras when, after her husband dies, she sees Jesus carrying that cross down the street. I don't know exactly what that means, but...
That Jesus had a diaper on.
Oh, so do most Jesuses.
Those are loincloths. That thing, like, he had a load in there.
Yeah.
It is Mardi Gras. He wouldn't be the only one to shit himself.
Yeah, he's doing the Stations of the Cross. You know, it's Clive Barker. He loves religious imagery. There was so much Salome in Hellraiser. And now, yeah, we have the Stations of the Cross. And so is she a martyr in some way? Like, what does it all mean? Well, in all Clive Barker works, I think sometimes that pretension doesn't totally pay out. But I appreciate it's here. I do think it adds to the allure that we have, yeah, a Christ figure, not unlike the, you know, homeless man that followed Kirstie around in Hellraiser. All right, so it's Fat Tuesday. My husband is dead. I would probably spend the whole day crying in the tub, but she is going to go try and find her missing student. Like, last thing on my mind. Hey, your student Matthew disappeared last night. It's Mardi Gras. Okay, yeah, he probably got into the liquor cabinet. I'm not going to worry about that, but no, she's going to spend the whole morning asking around and talking to his preacher father.
Couldn't it be that she's worried that the Candyman got him the way he got her husband? I don't know why he'd go after her students, but just to torment her, maybe?
Yeah, she says that. That's a line of dialogue. I feel guilty because I exposed these kids when I went to that school mirror and summoned him. So maybe she is worried that, I guess you could conclude that. There's no evidence of that other than some school kids knocked on her door and said, we can't find Matthew. And then she goes over to his house and, yeah, he drew a lot of pictures.
You'd think that they'd start there.
Yeah. Anyway, so again, I wish they wouldn't be doing the Matthew stuff. I feel like, again, trying to find who killed my father, trying to get my brother free, trying to find out who killed my husband. These are better hooks for the story.
Agreed. And we already have the child in danger with the unborn fetus. We don't need this kid who never once gets a hook to the neck. I mean, not even held to the neck. It's never even a danger.
Right. But he did draw a picture of the lynching. He seems to be teasing some of the lynching of Daniel Robitaille. When we finally get that story at the end, some of that imagery comes here when she's, you know, sifting through all of his drawings. So they're trying to prepare us for what they're building towards.
You guys kind of complained last time that we didn't have the name of Candyman. Does Daniel Robitaille stand with Jason Voorhees and Freddy Krueger?
No. I wanted an explanation for why he was called Candyman. I didn't care what his real name was, but Daniel Robitaille, you know, I know that name because I'm a Los Angeles Kings fan, and Luke Robitaille, one of the great Kings players in the 90s, but, you know, it's New Orleans, French, it makes sense.
Yeah, it works in the sense that if it's set in New Orleans, then, yeah, everyone has to be named Thibodeau and Robitaille, and, yeah. Good enough is, I suppose, like, it's one of those situations where you're like, oh shit, I've gotten what I asked for. I wanted more details about that storyline. We're definitely going to get more backstory here. They're going to explain everything that happened that made Candyman who he is. And they're going to show it. And are we better for having seen it all? I think is a fair question to ask, but we're not quite there yet. Let's get through some kills too, because this is a slasher.
Well, I think we got to get some snow cones first.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, sweets for the sweet, right? And so, I mean, it is kind of a provocative that he's, you know, got this phallic thing pouring the red on.
Pouring that cherry juice. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it kind of works in its own silly way that this is a man that apparently was talking to her father right before he died and wanted to sell him
snow cones.
Well, no, this old white chick, this painting that was done by Daniel Robitaille 100 years ago, he's got it. And for whatever reason, her dad thought it was important. Turns out it's going to be great, great, great grandma. So, yeah, he's going to lead her to this painting. It's going to, you know, I think we all know, right? The blonde hair is sort of like channeling everything. The idea, the mom.
Yes. Candyman has a type.
Right, yeah, he has a type. The mom has olden pictures. She's blonde, too. Like, it doesn't take a genius to figure out. You don't need Ancestry.com to realize, okay, I know where this is going. But we do need a good kill.
But it does not look like Virginia Madsen, like all the graffiti in New York, in Chicago.
You're holding on to that like that's truth, and I'm not even saying, again, he told her she was the one, but that was just his night in Chicago.
That was his pickup line.
Yeah, I don't know why you believe she has. Obviously, this woman in the portrait is not Virginia Madsen, and we're being told that she's the actual, real, true one. You got to read the book, right, by Purcell. It probably explains it all.
So it wasn't always her, Helen.
Right, no, it was never you. It was just you that one time because I wanted to get you with my hook. You got to feel cheap, right? Makes a girl feel lesser.
What do you think about, I guess, Candyman's weakness, like, you know, with Freddy, you got to bring him out into the real world so you could kill him. This, you just got to smash a mirror. I guess it's a really old mirror that you got to find first, but it seems very obvious and very stupid to me.
You need a talisman. I don't think that's stupid. I do think that every villain needs, something that makes them weak. The fact that he loved this woman, and the thing that we do not see, even in the flashback, is Daniel Robitaille as a human being. What he actually, how he met this woman, how they fell in love. Was it an act of just carnal lust?
Are you wishing for that? Because we might get it in part 3, and it's going to be really bad.
You're right, there's sequels. And so, yes, there's an opportunity to find this out. Yes, I'm going to wish for it, and maybe I'll regret.
It's going to be awful then.
I will maybe regret that wish. But yeah, I do feel like because we don't see any of that love story other than, you know, just these paintings here, you know, it looks saucy or whatever. I get that there was a sexual attraction between all of them, but I don't know. I don't know what was transpiring there and what he's holding on to.
I mean, they do make it sound like they were in love, like it wasn't just a one-night stand.
I guess. I think so. I'm not quite sure.
That's the vibe I got, at least.
You have to go with that. If he didn't love her, then this whole thing is moot. You have to go with the basic premise of it's his love and his passion, A, that got him killed, and B, that brought him back.
Yeah, and again, he deserves a few scenes to be Daniel Robitaille. He will never be Daniel Robitaille. He's always, Tony Todd is always Candyman in this movie. When he pops up here in this scene, it's just so that he can open up his rib cage and let the bees fly out and sting this guy to death. And this is also where we find out that Annie is pregnant. Up to this point, she did not know that.
Did you guys think, because what I thought was, oh, that's Candyman's baby. Like, he put a baby in her.
No, she had had sex with her husband, and I figured there had to be a reason for him.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, there was that scene.
It was the only purpose of him, and she'll have a scene where she goes home in the shower. Maybe it's just a titty shot, but she's rubbing her belly and saying, she seems to be glad to have something to hold on to with Paul.
There was so little mourning of her husband, I totally forgot she was married and had sex with him.
Yeah, admittedly, it is a very brief grief process for her on that.
I think that's the only reason he's keeping her alive, right? Let the bloodline propagate. Although he's more than happy to kill members of his bloodline. I mean, he killed her father. Later on, he's going to kill her mother. It's not like he wants them to live forever.
But we know the mom, she's embarrassed by it. And I'm assuming maybe the dad was too, and that's why he's trying to find this mirror and smash it and get rid of this whole myth. Like, again, I feel like there's an interesting subtext there about finding out, oh, we have slaves in our past that we've descended from, even though we're blonde, blue-eyed, and very white, like, embracing that past, but that never plays out, and I feel like that's a real lost moment for this film.
Yeah, it's confusing because she'll eventually go back to the Reverend, and he's like, oh yeah, I lied to you, I know Candyman's real, and in fact, he's buried over here in this mausoleum with Caroline Sullivan.
Yeah, the woman he had a baby with.
Wait a sec, though. How can he be buried if they scattered his ashes?
That's exactly where I was going with that. Again, like, why would you put him in the family crypt if you dragged him out and, like, covered him in honey and had him stung to death? I would think you wouldn't give him a proper burial. I wouldn't put him in the same, like, mausoleum as the woman that you were trying to protect him from.
Or was she put in his family's mausoleum, you know, that was bought with the shoemaker money?
They were super rich shoemakers.
I don't know. You know, again, there are questions still to be answered. That's why we have a Candyman 3. So
it is just not a tight narrative. And I do look to Jordan Peele's team to tighten this up.
Again, because you can say some of it is just a legend and some of it isn't, you take the best stuff and you throw away the rest. And yeah, there's a lot here that probably is going to go in the trash can. But yeah, we need to kill the mom, right? Like, she definitely deserves it for being lying, deceptive, that she knew something about her husband's death and Candyman that she just didn't want to come out. I mean, they're treating her like she owns slaves here, like that she in some way deserves this. And that seems a little unfair, but I don't have a problem with Veronica Cartwright getting it in the stomach.
I thought it was almost a mercy kill. I mean, if he wanted to make her suffer, let her die of that cancer. They mentioned she's lost a bunch of weight already. I mean, she's in for a long, slow, painful death. Candyman does her a favor.
Yeah. And at the same time, the cops are coming because they have bad news for the family. Ethan was killed because the police officer that was always interrogating him hated him and, you know, wanted to prove, I guess the thought was, I'm going to recite Candyman 5 times into the one-way mirror so to snap you out of the delusion that he's real. And they were both killed at the police station with that videotape.
But he was killed on video camera where the cops, as Jacob said, can see this like body floating. But Ethan, Candyman doesn't even kill Ethan. Ethan's like running from Candyman and the cops shoot him for suspected murder. I mean, that is the worst death in this entire movie. He's a useless character. Cut him.
I'm shocked, Arnie. I'm shocked you usually like death. Like, I associate you not having high demands in a slasher movie for a large quantity of death. You don't get any thrill from seeing a guy thrown out of his office and smashing on the secretary's desk. That wasn't kind of fun.
It was kind of fun, but I just don't think that Bill Condon is a good horror filmmaker. I don't think that these scenes had much suspense. When Candyman shows up and just immediately impales you with a hook, there's not a whole lot of fun there. I've said it before, terror is the moment before the knife plunges in the skin. Here, I don't even think the makeup effects look all that good. I don't feel like Tony Todd is filmed in such a way as to be as imposing as he was last time. I'm enjoying the stuff that we have with Annie, but if you're not going to service story or character, I don't care if you're killed. You at least be fun. Ethan isn't even fun. He doesn't even do anything. The opening with Purcell is the only reason to have Ethan at all. After that point, he sits in a jail cell. Admittedly, there's not a whole lot you can cut out of hour 35-minute movie and still have a running time. Maybe brother and sister could come together at the end, you know? Ethan had his trials with the cops, Annie had her trials with Candyman, and together, siblings sharing the blood of Candyman could overcome. But the fact that Ethan is shot to death by a cop, it just makes me feel I've wasted a lot of my time.
Oh, I mean, it's Candyman 2. I expect it to be a waste of time. I'm having a much better time than you, and I'm surprised to hear so much pushback. I'm not going to disagree with any of your major points, only with the forcefulness by which you demand they fix it. It's, yeah, it's this kind of sloppy crap that we get in every slasher horror sequel. Like, really? I mean, can you think of a Halloween movie or Nightmare on Elm Street movie that doesn't suffer these problems?
I don't feel some of them went to this extent. Jacob, where are you at this point? Where's your needle on this film?
Well, I agree with you, Stuart. This is just kind of a sloppy horror sequel, and that's just not my thing. I don't want that. I'm not that kind of a horror fan. I want it to be smart or thrilling or gory or just exploitive. And this is just kind of mediocre. I'm shocked that this actually came out in theaters, actually. I watching this, I would have thought this was direct to video. It's a mediocre sequel, and it's just kind of boring to me.
So let's get to the climax then. Sloppy, we can all agree. I'll insist, yes, it's very messy. I'm never quite sure what Annie is trying to do. Is she trying to solve her dad's murder, free her brother.
Find Amir.
Yeah, right. It's just...
Find Matthew. Remember Matthew?
Yeah, he's here in the climax. She finally decides to go back to that plantation and break every mirror, any mirror she can find, any reflective surface she's just stomping on.
Even though she saw a painting of the mirror, she's going to smash wall mirrors and everything. You know that's not it. She's just going to have like 49 years of bad luck.
All maybe. All I got to say is, like, did you really call, like, the place back behind your house the slave quarters? Like, that's, like, if you knew you had slave quarters, can you imagine, like, oh, maybe it's in the gas chamber that we have in the backyard. Like,
that's what I'm saying. This should be about confronting your racist past.
Yes.
Nope. Total missed opportunity for this film.
Yeah. So are we saying this should be period? Are we saying that this should be much closer to the Civil War and Reformation and all of that?
I do think it would be a stronger film if it wasn't the great, great, great granddaughter of Candyman. Like, maybe one great.
Yeah, slavery's got to matter. The horror of slavery is a part of this. And the fact that all these people, nobody here has owned slaves, and their parents didn't own slaves, and probably their parents, maybe they owned slaves, but it feels very removed from the problems. But then again, that is what we talk about when we talk about race relations in America. It's like, when are we done with it? So...
But this isn't about race relations. That's the problem.
And let me point out what Purcell said at the beginning. Candyman was never a slave.
And yet, at the same time, what, you know, it was what, 1890 or whatever? That's when Jim Crow laws started. That's when...
Yeah, it still wasn't great.
I'm not saying it's great, but I mean, he was not Chiwetel Ejiofor in 12 Years a Slave. He went to good schools. I mean, that's part of the story, is how he met the white woman to fall in love. It's not because he was out there being whipped and punished.
Well, Chiwetel Ejiofor was in the North, and he was educated and played the violin, and then he got tricked into being sold to the South.
Yeah, he just didn't get slathered with honey and have his hand cut off.
Yeah, so it is the story.
But we're supposed to think that before Chiwetel Ejiofor got kidnapped, that was the life Candyman led, not the life of singing hymnals while working the cotton fields.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that was his life. I mean, again, we know that there's a slave record that the preacher had, and that's about it. But I do feel like his birth, let me put it this way, he's about 30 in all of these flashbacks. And so that means he couldn't have been much more than a child when the Civil War ended.
But so much shoe money.
Yeah, I don't know. It's the shoes. Anyway, I mean, can we all agree the backstory wasn't good last time? And here we're going to get a lot more of it when they go into those slave quarters and Candyman wants you to, be my witness. It's not about being my victim. It's about witnessing what they did to me. And I wanted to know, and so now I know.
I gotta give it this. While I think the crowd's a little small...
Yep. That was my note.
And while I think that the fact that he's called Candyman just because a kid gets a drip of honey on his face...
And that's where sweets for the sweet come from as well.
Yeah, I think that's all pretty lame. But Tony Todd in this scene, we have only seen Tony Todd as an imposing figure of death, a complete scene stealing, all eyes on him, every moment, badass. And he pulls off fear here. I feel so bad for him. And it's not just because of what's happening, but the way he lays there and the way he looks so scared and everything. I think Tony Todd really sells the scene.
Again, I wish I had a fuller version of this character. I wish we had spent 20 minutes with Daniel Robitaille and saw all of it, not just his moment of pain. But yes, I do think it's important always in these to think about the moment where we are to like, right? I mean, it happens. At some point in a slasher series, we go from liking the victim into liking the oppressor. And so Candyman, I think in this moment, very clearly, suddenly becomes the hero of these movies. We like him a whole lot more than we like Annie, anyway.
Except he comes back with vengeance. I mean, we feel bad for him for what happens here, but killing all the people he's killed certainly doesn't make it right.
Well, neither did it for Freddy or Jason. Because he drowned doesn't mean he gets to chop up everyone else. But again, we find ourselves ultimately signing on to his rage. If we're going to keep doing Candyman 3s, 4s, and 7s, then yes, we've got to like Candyman more than anybody else.
And this was a problem I brought up with the first one. I'm like, well, what is this ultimately about? Black on black crime? Like, why is he going after his own? And yeah, I think they need to clean up his MO a bit better, who his victims are. And I could probably get more on his side, but I feel for him because it's horrible what this Daniel Robitaille had to endure.
Yeah, I feel like that this movie fixed that for you. Last time you were saying, I want to see him get revenge on the people that hurt him. And that is kind of what's been happening, I guess.
Yeah, that's the problem. It's kind of what happens in this.
Yeah. I mean, it's closer to it.
Yes, I'll give you that.
Yeah, it's closer to being a revenge storyline. I'm going to get the people and my descendants who are also my oppressors. I mean, that's the confusion, is the bloodline is both his and the people that killed him.
And Annie seems to be the personification of white guilt for her mother's denials of all this, right? I mean, that's all I could think of is, like, she is just, until the very end moments where she stands up for herself, she feels so bad for him. I'm not sure if she's trying to protect herself or save him.
Yeah, kind of both. And again, I feel like a stronger actress. I think Virginia Madsen would have been better in this. I mean, some of the problem is that we got a very bland person at the center. And so we're not really thinking about her or what she's doing or even why Candyman wants her. It's just, okay, let me tell you my story. Now break the mirror. Done. And we get some CGI that is just, it was kind of fun. You got to admit, I know it's bad and we could pick on it all day, but isn't it kind of fun that they put this in a professional movie, like him breaking into pieces?
Oh, it's so bad. So bad.
Okay, I'm going to stand alone. I loved it. Non-ironically.
Non-ironically?
No, you are the CGI snob. How did you love this?
Because I felt it was stylized and, like, you're breaking glass and so he breaks like glass.
I got that. I understood that. It looks awful, though.
Oh, yeah. No, it's pretty damn clear that that's what they're trying for. But again, I agree. I love it. We'll meet there. I love it, too. But unironically, it's a surprise.
I mean, it reminded me, admittedly, this is many years earlier, and this looks better than that. But I was thinking young Sherlock Holmes with the stained glass mirror man.
I mean, okay, if that's where your mind went.
No, it doesn't look that good.
It looks better than that.
No, it doesn't look better than that at all.
I'm really surprised because I always feel like you're the one that sometimes the fun just stops when an effect doesn't work and you just say, I hate it.
I think this effect works is the funny thing.
That is the shock. Is that, yeah, like, that is, it's wow. Very clear that this effect does not work, but you can't see that. It's fine. Okay. Sure, it's fine.
I thought it was a clever way. Last time we burned him. I mean, you need a new way to kill these people. Freddy had been turned into bursts of light, and then finally he was torn apart and melted and all these things. Here, this is a way I've never seen a horror villain killed before.
You're just happy because it's a new way to die.
And if it's the themes of the movie, yeah.
Despite it looking awful. Okay.
At any rate, can we agree that the model of the slave quarters washing away, at least, really Land of the Lost, Sid and Marty Krofft style?
Auntie M! Auntie M!
Yeah, it's really something. Again, it's makes me wish that maybe they should have played the whole thing for funnier than they did. But it's hard to do that. It's hard to reference America's racist past and then be like a campy fun thing. And yeah, you get the mishmash that you get here at the end. It's now Lent. Ash Wednesday, they're going to go to church, and Matthew and Annie are going to get the crosses on their forehead and prepare for Crescent City to do it all over again. Kingfish is going to say, I hope you had a fun farewell to the flesh, but that is a cycle. Candyman's not done. And we know this because there's a Candyman 3.
And we jump 5 years ahead and see little Caroline, named after Candyman's beloved, is a little girl who is being told about her history. She knows Daniel Robitaille is one of her ancestors, but for smart reasons, Annie isn't going to tell her the whole story until she's much older. And yet somehow this little girl knows to say Candyman.
Yeah, that's what I thought was weird, because she's telling the story to her daughter, but she doesn't tell her the Candyman part.
Maybe she heard it at school. Again, kids learn early these days. You know, parents are usually the last ones to be able to tell their kids what's going on with the, you know, the birds, the bees, and
the Candyman.
The killers, yeah, they're coming with them.
I thought we'd at least see like a glimpse of Tony Todd in a mirror, even if he didn't kill anyone. Like, just, you know, you got that end stinger there. But no, it just kind of ends.
Something I've noticed is that he's really not in these movies very much. For as much as his presence looms large and he's this legend that people are always whispering about, what, another 8 minutes in this film? Tops?
I think he got more time in this one, didn't he?
Maybe.
Well, I'm going to blow your guy's mind.
Uh-oh.
The next movie is all about little Caroline.
What, this child?
Yeah. Only it's 25 years later and is played by Donna DeErico.
A Baywatch?
Yes.
Oh, my.
Oh, so what you're telling me is get the hook ready.
Yeah, already give it a not recommend.
Okay, I'm coming for you.
But before we get to the Playmate of the Month, Jacob Stewart, do you recommend Candyman, Farewell to the Flesh? Jacob.
I think we've all had a good time making fun of this movie, pointing out its flaws, because there are a lot of flaws here. It's sloppy, kind of directionless. It's missing that subtext and that mood that I really enjoyed from the first Candyman film. But watching this, I mean, look, I think it's a pretty average slasher sequel. So if you're the kind of person that just likes horror movies, like I like kung fu movies, like I'll sit down and just watch about any kung fu movie and get through it and kind of enjoy it. Like, I think if you're in that crowd for horror, you'll kind of enjoy this. You'll get to see some blood and a guy with a hook stabbing people and all that kind of stuff. But for me, because it's missing that stuff that I think works so well with the first one, even though that had some sloppy storytelling as well, just that mood and all the stuff about race relations and I wish they kind of carry that on. But yeah, this, it's just a sloppier film that I didn't enjoy as much. So again, if you just are an easy lay for horror, I think you'll do fine with this, but I'm not going to give it my endorsement. So it's a weaker not recommend.
Stuart.
You know, it's kind of the Poltergeist 2 of the series. I mean, I that comparison to me, what that means is Poltergeist 2, the subtitle was The Other Side. And when you watch Poltergeist, you're like, yeah, I want to know what's on the other side of that closet. I want to see it. You spend the whole Poltergeist 2. I want to know what happened to Candyman. We were told this crazy story about a shoemaker in the 1890s that made his kid educated and painted and yeah, something to do with a honeycomb and a hook for a hand. How does that all play? I want to see that. Well, you see it. This movie is going to show it to you. And for good and bad ways, now I know. In many ways, they explain and make plausible the urban legend that Purcell talked about in that first movie. And you got to love New Orleans. Just as a backdrop, it works just as well as Chicago and Cabrini Green. I think that they amplify in many ways the whole miscegenation, the lynching, the horrors of Civil War and Jim Crow era. There's still enough of the flavor that I liked about Candyman to say that, yeah, it kind of works. But then, you know, Poltergeist 2 is kind of a shitty movie, too. And there's so much that you could rag on, including Annie. I wish I liked her half as much as Candyman does. And yeah, I wish that we had more organization to the mystery, that it wasn't so scattered. I am going to give this Farewell a weak recommend. I'm going to just go with what Jacob's talking about. As someone that sat through a lot of slasher movie series and thinking about the average middling Halloween sequel, this is about as good as that. This is about usually what a franchise at its height will do once it gets going and cranking out sequels. So, yes, is it as good as the original? Absolutely not. Is it a step down? Sure. But if they can keep this level of quality, then I'm going to hang in the congregation. I think that I can roll with this level of silly.
And I was a little bit torn in the flesh for this one. I mean, I like Tony Todd in this a lot. I like him as Candyman, and I really felt for him as Daniel Robitaille. And some of the kills are fun. I can't deny that either. Some of them are very perfunctory, like Purcell, and the mom kind of gets it pretty quick, but there is a pretty high body count. I really like when the art dealer snow cone guy dies because he gets covered in bees and they're all in his mouth and everything. I thought that was a really fun death that we kind of glossed over. But man, this story is all over the map. And my problem is I find myself really struggling to give a shit about Annie. You know?
Yeah. No, I don't like her either. And yeah, it's too bad. You miss Virginia Madsen.
A lot. What really made that last movie work was Virginia Madsen and her plight and the fact that even when Candyman wasn't around, she was still being persecuted. Here, Annie's just wandering around. She's wandering around New Orleans, which is great. And I think that they filmed the outside stuff pretty well. But I was really on the fence with this one when all came down. And in the end, I think Annie shouted too much. It really got on my nerves. Now, I did have to watch this twice in a row, once with commentary. But by the end of the second time, I'm just like, stop screaming. Oh, my Lord.
Were the screams so loud it came over the director talking about the film?
Yes, it did. And he didn't talk enough. There were some times where it just went back to the movie for like 5 minute stretches.
I hate those kind of commentaries.
So I'm going to go very, very weak, not recommend. And
holy shit, I'm the only one giving this a green arrow?
You really are.
Stuart, I already know I'm setting myself up because I do this every time. I try to hold the second sequel up to the standard of the first. And then as we get on later and later and later, they're so bad. I'm like, oh, I kind of wish I would have recommended it.
Yes, you wish you had been kinder. You're going to be wish you were nicer to this flesh. You're going to wish you didn't say farewell so quick.
It's like Hellraiser 2. I'm like, ah, that one wasn't so bad after seeing these later ones.
It's so true. That is so true. And I guess maybe that's what I've learned or I've been conditioned at this point of like, if it just gets this bad, it's okay. But it won't. It'll get so much worse. What did you say? The Baywatch woman's in it next week? Okay. Horrendous. I can't wait.
But what I'll say is, I think this is why I'm not a huge Candyman fan and why I wasn't jonesing for Candyman 4 and why when I heard it was being rebooted, I only got really excited when I found out Jordan Peele was behind it. You know, unless you're bringing Barker back or a visionary like Peele, Candyman never really did it for me other than that first movie. I mean, to preview my thought, I don't think anybody's expecting us to like part 3 with Donna D'Errico, so I haven't rewatched it. And I don't remember anything about it. All I know, direct-to-video, Baywatch Babe, Playboy Playmate, and Tony Todd. So maybe it's great. We'll find out next week.
I only know one thing, and it was just because I was just looking at where he was going to go. Because that's the interesting thing. If nothing else, it's a travelogue. Chicago, New Orleans. We're going to be in L.A. all next week because we're going to start with Snake Plissken trying to escape L.A. And then Candyman is going to take it to East L.A.
Is he going after Chicanos if it's East L.A.?
I held back from reading too much, but yes, maybe.
It is where Cheech and Chong were born.
And it is Day of the Dead, so.
All right, well, listeners, thank you for your support. We really do appreciate it. Without your guys' support, we'd have to say farewell to the podcast. So thank you so much for keeping us going and keeping some meat on our bones. I tried to make the carnival thing work. I'm not sure it did.
Just say farewell. Farewell to the fans.
So Jacob Stewart, thank you for joining me. It was for you, our listeners. It was always for you.
Once again, thank you for supporting Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this bonus movie review.
Sweet to the sweet.
Your support helps keep Now Playing on the air.
I have a curriculum I have to follow here.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
I can't say nothing, or Candyman'll get me.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
Hands up, people! Five more! Come out the back door! Police!
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
Why? If you would learn just a little from me, you would not beg to live.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
What do the good know except what the bad teach them by their excesses?
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2020, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Our names will be written on 1,000 walls, our crimes told and retold by our faithful believers. We shall die together in front of their very eyes and give them something to be haunted by. Come with me and be immortal.
Yeah, I mean, this just didn't perform. It ended up making 10,000 less than the first one did in theaters. Against Outbreak, by the way, it was competing for theater screens with the Dustin Hoffman virus movie.
Wait, 10,000 less or 10 million less?
I'm sorry, yeah.
Yeah. 10,000 less, that's pretty good for a sequel.
Yeah, okay. For whatever reason, her dad thought it was important. Turns out it's going to be great-great-great-grandma.
Who is this actor playing the art dealer? He looked really familiar to me.
I mean, not to me, so I can only assume that it, Wishmaster 7 or something like that.
Yeah, Picket Fences, maybe?
Real genius. Matt Clark is his name.
Yeah, I kind of clicked on his name. I figured you guys would have some real quick references for him, but
I've never seen him before.
Back to the Future 3, I guess he was a cowboy.
Sure.
That's his number one credit. Jeremiah Johnson, that
Robert Redford?
Yeah, Redford film. Yeah, I don't recognize any of these characters, though, in movies I've seen.
Yeah, I have no idea who this guy is. He must just have one of those faces.
Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai, I've seen that, but I don't remember him in that.
Okay, just cut all that shit. He's nobody.
Looper.
He's absolutely fucking nobody.
I mean, really, are you anyone if you haven't been in Real Genius?
You know, she knows Daniel Robidoux, but not...
Robitaille.
But she knows...
Robidope. Shubidoo.
Here's the thing, that there was a Rubidoux in ER, and I always thought Robidope was Rubidoux. I like Tony Todd in this a lot. I like him as Candyman, and I really felt for him as Daniel. Robitaille. Whatever.
Ropadope.
You got it right that time.
No, he did.
I felt like you said that just so you could get it right for once.
Yeah.